everyone, and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live, the podcast. I am Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and the lady sitting across from me who's trying not to laugh is
Gabriel Chan, political correspondent with Guardian Australia.
And we're here to confront the epic piece of information that we have lived 12 months since the July
we
election.
We have.
We're still here.
Yep.
We don't quite know how. But anyway, we do love anniversaries in political journalism because it gives us an excuse to jump off the travelator, which we're on all the time now, of just churning through this development and that development and trying to make sense of it. So we can indulge the odd conversation like this one. So over the next little bit, we're going to think about 12 months on from the election, what we know, what we don't know, what's the same, what's different, what's changed. But I think before we wade into that bigger conversation, sadly it's impossible to just start with that conversation without referencing the events of this week.
The cherry bar.
I don't know why I think it's cherry bomb. I've got John Mellencamp in my head for some weird reason.
It's not the cherry bomb.
Thanks,
well, guys. It was actually the cherry bomb in the cherry bar.
What?
Well, it was a bombshell, wasn't it?
Oh, of course.
A liberal bombshell.
Oh, I'm terribly
a moderate
sorry.
Bombshell.
I'm so sorry. Duh. I completely miscued. Yes, Gabby's quite right. There was a bombshell in the cherry bar, which has set various pulses racing over the course of this week. Now, you start, Gabby. What did last week mean?
Well,
what was that about?
Broadly speaking, well, it started with Christopher Pyne in the cherry bar.
As it
indeed on a Friday night after Federal Council getting around with a few hundreds of his mates that are on the moderate side of the Liberal Party, otherwise known as the left.
Yes.
And he basically indulged in a little bit of triumphalism, said that we'd won, the moderates, we've won, and we're working towards getting an outcome on marriage equality, and it might be sooner rather than later.
Dun, dun, dun. Yes. And then what happened next?
And then more bombshells outside the cherry bar.
They took it outside.
They
took their bombshell outside.
Take it outside. And rounds of, I told you so, followed by Tony Abbott coming out and saying, well, hey, Christopher, you were in my leadership group. I thought you were loyal to me. Oh, I should say also that Christopher Pyne said that he'd always voted for Malcolm Turnbull in
forever.
Every ballot. Even though he was in the Abbott leadership group and that he and George Brandis had kept the faith, to which George presumably was sinking into his chair in the cherry bar.
Yes.
His stool.
Well, yes, or hiding behind a fern of some type.
Yep.
I don't know if there are ferns in the cherry bar. That's speculation.
But I love the detail of it. But broadly speaking, it just opened up the war between moderates and conservatives in the Liberal Party that has plagued the party really well before the leadership changeover, but it's reignited it.
Yeah. Well, it was particularly nasty, I think, in this instance because I think there's sort of been, and this gets us into slightly into 12 months territory, 12 months on from the election, I think there's sort of been two phases of Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister. And this is at one level a gross simplification, but I think a reasonable one. The opening stanza of Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister was there was a lot of accommodation of the right, a lot of overt accommodation of the right on a range of fronts, safe schools, sticking with a plebiscite, killing emissions trading before it even got out of the blocks. There were all kinds of concessions basically given up front to the right. I think the sort of first 6 months of this year we've seen the Prime Minister in a different phase where he's sort of, I think he thinks that there's sort of only one way to stay on your feet and that's to stay on your feet. So craft an agenda and try and push it through. And I think he made the decision and the government made the decision that they needed to use the budget to reposition the government, put them back in the political centre. That necessitated sort of subset issues like the school's funding debate and other things that they sort of unveiled in the budget. A lot of Conservatives didn't like the budget in any shape or form, thought that the repositioning in the centre was you know, not what they wanted. That we saw a fight erupt over the school's funding issue with a big transfer of wealth from the public from the private system, the Catholic system, to the public system. A lot of Conservatives unhappy about that. So that's been a thing sitting there, simmering behind the scenes. Also, the energy debate, which hasn't concluded yet in government ranks. I think a lot of Conservatives see a moderate agenda trying to be pushed through in terms of the clean energy target that was recommended by the chief scientist, Alan Finkel. A lot of Conservatives think that that's full moderate in its agenda and resist that as well. So it's sort of like, I think everyone, there'd been this sort of period of sort of gritting teeth internally. Yes, I can see what Malcolm's doing. I can see that he's repositioning the government. He's trying to refresh and sort of change the perceptions of what the government is and what it's about. People have been gritting their teeth for months.
And do you mean gritting teeth on one side or the other?
I mean Conservatives gritting
right.
teeth.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Mm. That a lot of people sitting around thinking, oh, God, this is crap, but maybe it'll work, so I'll just shut up.
Mm.
And then Christopher Pyne's little provocation in the bar was enough to just, well, and particularly given marriage was involved, because it's sort of funny, we have this conversation about the left and the right of the Liberal Party as if that's even a thing, a coherent thing, when it really isn't. The sort of, you know, it used to be between, the debate used to be between wets and dries, and it was an economic schism between right and left. It's not now. The schism between right and left in the Liberal Party is on identity politics and social debates.
Issues, yeah.
It's like that's completely, that calculus has completely changed. So for Christopher Pyne to stand up and say, we've won on marriage, or we will win on marriage, wink, wink, that was why things erupted so spectacularly, because it's in that context of a bunch of Conservatives sitting there for months just shutting up and just saying, okay.
Yeah, he couldn't have picked a more controversial issue,
yeah.
Could he?
Yeah. It's, I think,
dare we say, totemic.
Yeah, well, it sort of is.
Mm.
It's kind of nuts.
Mm.
Like, truly, I find it hard to fathom. But it is a totemic issue. It became the line, you know, the line you will not cross.
Mm.
And that's why we've seen such a visceral response. Just for folks out there watching on through the headlines of the week and thinking, what the hell is this about? This is just crazy. Because in reporting periods like this, we political journalists can get so obsessed with kind of racking up the next increment that we forget to actually just stop and say what the story is, stop and explain what's actually going on. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's for what it's, that's my view, for what it's worth. That's the sort of prelude to the anniversary, is that Conservatives have been good little soldiers over the first 6 months of this year, relatively speaking. Pyne completely inadvertently blew it up. They've had a good old punch up for this week, and then we roll into the anniversary and beyond.
Yeah. I mean, the context too is it was done in New South Wales, in Sydney, and New South Wales is probably the most factional state,
yeah.
Where this runs deep, but also is controlled by the moderate.
Yes,
wing.
Yeah, the moderates are
and
in the
so
ascendancy, yeah.
Christopher may well have thought he was in pretty safe territory, notwithstanding there was anywhere between, you know, 80 to 150 people,
yes,
in the room.
All with iPhones.
Or any phones.
Exactly.
Yes.
All with a recording device,
yeah,
in,
yes,
the pocket.
Exactly.
Just in the event,
yeah,
you know, someone shot off their mouth in a bar after midnight. Yeah, it's sort of, yes, yeah, New South Wales, you're right, is an important sort of other layer of context, what's going on here, because it is the site of this, of, well, a kind of, well, a, a fierce war between.
And has factions. Been since, you know, since Tony Abbott was a young boy kicking around trying to get a seat in Warringah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not only, I mean, this is a whole other pod, but it's not only in New South Wales, although we take the most notice of New South Wales because there's sort of live fights about party rules and all
and
that.
Leaders
sort of stuff.
And leaders come
out of Sydney.
Yeah.
But it's there's sort of there's myriad problems all around the place. There's this quite sort of complex factional dynamics in Victoria as well. There's sort of concerns about the Liberal Party and WA and sort of takeover by evangelical groups and so on and so forth. It's quite a sort of complicated set of dynamics. But anyway, that's a whole other pod and we're wandering off 12 months, which is the goal we set ourselves in this conversation, Gabby.
Okay, I've got a question, a 12-month question for you. You talked about Malcolm Turnbull's first phase after leadership and, you know, calming the horses and calming, not to mention the Conservatives. You know, I'm not going to do anything crazy out of the box here. Then he does the Senate reforms before the last election.
Yeah.
If he had have got a larger majority, would he have continued on with the Conservative stuff? I mean, the minority Senate has allowed him to say, hey, we've tried all this.
Yeah.
We tried the 2014 budget proposals. They've been knocked back so many times. In order to get something through, I have to compromise. And by compromising, it makes it a more moderate sounding proposal.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying, and it's sort of it's imponderable at one level. Your question is basically, had he not been checked by the voters in the sense of being given a one seat majority and the Senate that he's been given, would he have still tried to be a prime minister in sort of broadly accommodating mode? Well, God knows, really. And we were, I think, the sort of defining image for me of the 12 months ago is that. That speech he gave on election night, which I still have a really vivid memory of, just his complete shock at confronting the reality that was now before him, that he'd gone into an election cycle hoping for a definitive mandate and he'd come out the end of this punishing 2 month election campaign hanging on by his fingernails. And sort of, you could see that
he was angry. He was so angry. It was after midnight, remember?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd been blogging for a fair while.
I don't know, about 15 hours or so. You know, who's counting? But after midnight, he'd been holed up.
And
in,
it was shocking.
He was shocked.
Yeah.
He was floored.
Yeah.
He was completely floored that was how his election story ended. And, you know, 12 months on, has anything much changed? You wrote a lovely write-up of his performance at Cooma this week in his leather jacket up there.
Cut to the leather jacket. Well, that's what I wonder, you know, that's why I asked the question that in a way, you can't sell it that this slim majority of one in the lower house is by any means an advantage for him.
Yeah.
But it has pushed him into a space that he more naturally sells.
Yes.
A policy space he more naturally sells.
A more pragmatic space.
Yeah.
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 No,
which
no,
is
no,
sort of more centre space. But he's still almost as frustrated as he was on that election night down there in Cooma, trying to talk about his big nation building projects like the start of maybe the Snowy Hydro 2.0. And all journalists could ask about was, you know, Christopher Pyne's remarks, Tony Abbott, aren't you going to put him, you know, slap him down, put him in the box? His frustration was palpable again.
Yeah. Well, it is sort of striking that 12 months on, nothing's changed in many respects, except, of course, it has, which again is your point, that he's sort of been pushed back into more pragmatic territory. The government's sort of putting one foot in front of the other with its legislative achievements, so the settling of the schools funding debate, childcare policy passed, various watered-down IR things for a bit of red meat for the base, all that sort of stuff. It's kind of, it's all happening, and you're right, circumstances in a funny way have kind of validated his natural instinct, which is to be more in the centre. I think it's more, though, than having to deal with the Senate. I think myself, the most interesting political speech of this year was delivered by Scott Morrison last weekend.
At the Federal Council, yeah. The famous Federal Council.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. All roads lead back to the Federal Council, believe it or not. But I thought, and if pod folks haven't caught up with that speech yet, there's lots of reports. I wrote a report, various people did, so you can track it down easily enough. What he said, and this is sort of relevant to where the government is, Morrison said in quite stark terms, really, that the voters are not listening. The voters have fully tuned out. The voters are not interested in partisan culture war in Canberra. They're completely removed from that.
From one of the biggest warriors.
I know. You've got to. You've sort of got to. There's a few barriers to entry with this. The primary one being that the deliverer of this message is Scott Morrison. You've got to manage yourself through that kind of bump and look at the content. Look at what he's saying. And as a diagnosis of the problem, I think it was a very acute diagnosis of the problem. I think he sort of had to produce some pat solutions that were sort of superficial and laughable, really. So set aside the solutions, which are no solutions at all. I mean, the point is that there is no solution to this problem. But, again, to that central point about where the government's positioning itself, well, even tribal warriors like Scott Morrison, if we look at his rhetoric in the lead up to the budget and subsequently, he's trying to dial it down.
Mm.
He is trying to dial it down and talk in some sort of talk consensus language, talk in some sort of postpartisan language that we've got to come together, we've got to make agreements, we've got to do this, that, and the other thing. And he sort of used the National Disability Insurance Scheme as a kind of rallying cry around that and got rebuffed by Labor. But it's sort of I'm not making this point very sharply, but what I'm trying to say is the Senate is one dynamic about this, and the one seat majority is another. But I think sitting behind it is a knowledge that the government has that that the voters have switched off, and part of the reason they've switched off is because there is this gulf. It's sort of in Canberra we're in this. In certainly in terms of the internal politics of the government, you know, it's so ideological. It's so sort of, you know, they're all dripping in culture war. They're sort of obsessed by all this stuff, and people out there in the public
could not give
two rats. And it's sort of like all of a sudden.
Which may explain the polls too.
Well, I think it does.
Yeah.
I think it does. I think it's sort of the only real explanation that makes sense, that it's kind of that they've just said don't, just shut up.
Mm.
I'm not interested until you're going to say something that I'm remotely interested in. Shut up. Just stay out of my face. And then you have this conundrum for Turnbull because he's genuinely trying to execute a pivot here. He's genuinely trying to say to voters, look, I know you looked up before and we seemed quite nasty and we broke promises and we were kind of way over to the right and I know you saw all that and I'm trying to fix it. But it's kind of like people are just like, don't care.
Mm. There were a couple of other versions of it too. Peter Dutton today on radio, being pushed by 2GB's Ray Hadley to say, Hadley was saying, you know, you're the Conservative leader we all need and why don't we get rid of all of these moderates, these terrible moderates like Pine? And Dutton actually said, well, I think we get better outcomes when we have a diversity of views around the table, you know, pick me up off the floor. You know, you get a more rounded decision and whatever your view of Howard was, you know, he had both moderates and conservatives in, you know, in his government. although he kept conservatives on quite a short lead, yeah, it must be said.
Some of them were a couple of house pets, but they were around. It's true. They were around.
In the vicinity.
They were, and periodically they squeaked something or other before. Yes. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's sort of and the other little story about this 12 months and is this this sort of media chorus that's sort of plays into the right wing base, Hadley Jones, Andrew Bolt, Peter Credlin, who's, you know, once a backroom operative, now allegedly a media commentator, that there is this really, I think for Turnbull, incredibly difficult feedback loop that creates, because those people are basically hostile to him. It's obvious from you know, their whole positioning that they're hostile to him. Liberal Party members listen to those people. They consume that media. There's a sort of feedback loop that then happens with members being unrest among the membership. What's going on? You know, and the membership goes every which way. You know, some of it's sort of, yes, Malcolm's a communist. Others is, you know, why are these people shouting about us? Why can't you fix this up? Why can't you make it better? A lot of MPs report that to me, that there is this,
yeah, same,
this feedback loop that goes, and that's really difficult phenomenon to manage too, because it's funny. It's sort of like these are sort of niche audience kind of publications and media figures, even though they, you know, they sort of style themselves as being bigger than that, but that it is kind of niche and segmented, so it's kind of like a bubble cacophony. But still, it has implications beyond the bubble.
And sort of more dangerous in a lot of way for a coalition government than the left.
Yeah, well, quite. It's quite difficult. It's really quite difficult to manage. There's not easy solutions. And I know certainly Turnbull is telling colleagues in the government that the only way that they can try and push through it is to try and step around the filter as much as possible, you know, do a lot of direct publishing to social media.
He's doing a lot of Facebook live events.
Yeah, like, and I think he will do more of that to try and push past that sort of feedback loop problem they've got. But it is like, you know, we can sit around and laugh about it and think this is all a bit of sort of like a Gilbert and Sullivan opera. It's sort of ridiculous at one level, but it's not. It actually has tangible effects and consequences, and that's difficult. Anyway, we've managed to get through quite a long conversation without really mentioning Tony Abbott's name all that often, which is, I think, quite disciplined of us. But I think he's going to come up, because I do have a final question I think we need to chew over before we say goodbye for this week, and that is, what do we think's going to happen? Just listeners, I'll just share.
Oh,
Gabby just
God.
Almost fell off
the
chair.
I mean, really.
She did.
Option A, B, C, D, E, F, you know, all the way down.
Yeah.
Anything can happen from here.
Yeah.
The feedback that I always get from coalition MPs who are stuck in that loop that you were just talking about is, you know, the more conservative voters will come to them and say, well, you know, Malcolm's terrible, he's a communist, whatever he is. Okay, so who should be in there?
Crickets.
And Tony, you know, for all his, I mean, I heard Peter Credlin today saying that he didn't want to be Prime Minister again.
No, to I heard that too.
I think I hit my head somewhere. But, you know, let's face it, he doesn't command the votes in the party room.
Yeah.
But you're not ruling him out.
No, no, I'm certainly not. It seems stupid because I totally agree with what Gabby just said. There's no real coalescence on the right around an alternative figure to Malcolm Turnbull. We sort of had the Dutton phase, which kind of rose and now seems to have floated off into sort of a bit more never-never space. Tony Abbott is an extremely divisive figure internally. There's a lot of conservatives who just view his behaviour as entirely destructive. But being around this rodeo long enough particularly over the last 10 years and the disruption and dysfunction of the last 10 years in politics, to understand that if, I don't know, 6 months' time, 12 months' time, I wouldn't put a figure on it, but at a certain point in time, if the government, if there's no movement in the polls, if Scott Morrison's right and there's basically an ice wall now between establishment politicians, or in this case the government and the voters, polls don't move at all, then marginal seats holders start to panic. And in that environment, anything happens.
Yeah, but the leadership numbers, his leadership numbers in the electorate, surely if you're a panicky marginal MP, you look at those numbers that are produced every so often, you know, he's almost in the single digits as far as voters go.
No, I know, but it's...
So it's not like a Rudd proposition where you're trying to save the furniture, so-called, even though that's arguable too. Why would you go there?
There you are, everyone. There's the eternal why right there. well, no, of course, why? And the sort of... if we pull away... Look at the sort of 10 years of disruption and dysfunction in this place in terms of these cycles of leadership instability. If we can take away any message or lesson from that, it's don't bloody well change leaders. Mm. It creates consequences that are as hard to manage as having a leader who can't cut through and can't connect with the Australian people. So obviously it's kind of mad, but... This is all I could say this with a certain amount of certainty. If there's no movement in the polls, Abbott will be front stabbing Malcolm Turnbull as he does now every other day. He will say something like, "I'm a better campaigner than him. I want to save the furniture and I can." I'm popular in areas where we are at risk of losing seats, like outer suburbs. Tony's tradies, regional areas, Queensland, WA. I know those regions. I can campaign in those regions. And I, you know, instead of being a closet communist who would like to secretly do deals with Bill Shorten, I want to kill Bill Shorten. And I can kill Bill Shorten. I can divide and conquer in Labor's divided constituency. I can do that. And if I'm not making any predictions. Obviously, it's impossible given the fluid, dynamic, crazed environment that we inhabit to make a prediction beyond the next 5 minutes. But I can see a set of circumstances where Abbott would make that case. And where some people may be susceptible to that case being made. It's sort of like, in a way, it's like the tail end of Rudd and Gillard. People didn't go back to Rudd at the sort of tail end of that government thinking they were going to win that election. I mean, maybe Kevin Rudd did because it's the nature of the beast. Maybe he did, but no one else did. So it's kind of like... a different psychology hits at a time where you're literally confronting a date with destiny, i.e. an election, and whether or not you might survive it. And in that case, you make a decision as a marginal seats holder about the leader who you think is best placed to help you keep your seat. And in that environment, sort of the broader calculations of does he cut through at the national level, do people like him? Is he an electoral asset across the board? Those calculations are second order issues to how do I keep my seat? It literally kind of gets that sort of lowest common denominator. And look, I don't know. Maybe Malcolm Turnbull has a magic wand. Maybe he can turn around this dynamic. Maybe he can start to communicate with voters in a way where they will all of a sudden look up and say, okay, yes, you are worth listening to. I will listen to you. Maybe he does have those skills. He will be backing himself to have those skills. But it's an extremely difficult proposition, I think, on current evidence to see how he turns it around, because sort of becomes, in a way, it's self-fulfilling. All you can do is put your head down, put one foot in front of the other, keep trying to nudge your agenda through, build yourself a bedrock, build yourself a legacy so you can say, look, I did all these things. I'm not just occupying the space. I'm doing all these things, and they're beneficial to you, or however you want to frame it if you're Malcolm Turnbull. But it's the whole environment is very cluttered. And I think Scott Morrison's right. I think voters are in a quantifiably different place to the space that major party politics is being practiced in. And I don't know how you fix that.
So what you're saying is, unless Turnbull turns around some decent, or puts some decent runs on the board,
yeah,
in the next 12 months,
yeah,
he's cactus.
I wouldn't put it that strongly. I wouldn't put it that strongly, because they may not panic. They mightn't. But I think,
having had the examples before,
I know,
them, it never works.
I know. But it's sort of like, we can't. Our greatest fault, Gabriel Chan and I and others, we assume reason. We assume that politicians are rational actors. We assume there is a plan. We assume that people are capable of learning from past experience. But I confess, my sort of certainty in all of that has been shaken over the last decade. I'm not so sure now that those verities hold. And in that environment, I think anything can happen. And even people who are, you know, great supporters of Turnbull and remain supporters of Turnbull concede privately that anything could happen, really, over the next sort of 12 months or so. But anyway, on that cheery note, 12 months on from the election, anything can happen. Thank you for listening. We really do appreciate it. Appreciate it when you tune in every week. If you get us from iTunes, to stop by and leave us a rating or a review, that's enormously helpful to the profile of the podcast. And if you don't subscribe, if you've just got us off the website, please subscribe. You can subscribe on whatever your favoured podcast app is, and I think we're available on other platforms too. You can find us. We're easy to find.
We're around.
We are. We're around. It's true. We are. We hang around. Really good if you do. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni, who is the erstwhile producer of this podcast and deals with all manner of crazy. Thank you, Miles. Gabby and I are about to have a couple of weeks off, one after the other, so I'm not quite sure whether we will have a pod in our normal weekly slot or not over the next little bit. But even if we're on a short hiatus, we will be back with you before
Certainly.
You know it. So until we see you again, be well.
See ya.
Don't panic.